Well, hello and good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. As Daphne said, my name is Hannah Cooper, and I'll be speaking today on the war on drugs, excessive police-related violence, and health disparities. And just as a word of warning, I'm getting over a cold. I'll try not to hack all over the microphone, but just getting over that. So in the 20 minutes or so that I have with you, I want to cover an awful lot of ground, and I'll do it as well as I can. I'd first like to define what excessive police-related violence is. I'd like to give a very brief history of the intertwined nature of policing and racial hierarchies in the U.S. and also describe the war on drugs. And then I'd like to talk about the consequences of the war on drugs for racial ethnic disparities in two distinct health outcomes, HIV among drug users and high blood pressure in the general population. I don't have any traditional conflict to report. I will say, though, that the APHA definition of a conflict I find to be very limited. One thing that we've learned from critical race theory, from eco-social theory, from anyone doing qualitative work that involves reflexivity, is that one's social position shapes how you see the world, it shapes the kinds of questions that you ask about that world. So in a presentation about police brutality and health disparities, I think it matters that I'm white and that I'm affluent. I'm not going to be the target of police brutality, and I benefit daily from the system of white supremacy that police brutality supports. I'm also a queer femme, but frankly, the police typically can't pick up on that when I'm out in public spaces. So as you listen to this presentation, I ask that you think critically about how my social position might limit my understanding of police brutality and its health consequences. So with that said, let's jump in and define excessive police-related violence. So according to WHO, WHO defines violence regardless of the perpetrator as the intentional use of physical force or power, threatened or actual, against oneself, another person, or against a group or community that either results in or has a high likelihood of resulting in harm. WHO identifies four types of violence: physical violence, sexual violence, psychological violence, and neglectful violence. Today, I'd like to focus on stop and frisk as a form of psychological violence. We have, I think, finally started focusing on police brutality, police killings of black men and women as a public health issue, and that's vitally important, and it took, I would say, centuries overdue. But what I want to bring to the fore today is the psychological violence that relentless stop and frisk can create and its health effects, because I worry that that's not really on the radar for a lot of public health professionals. Now, police officers are, in fact, empowered to use some level of violence in order to enforce the law. But officers should only use the minimum amount of force that's needed to control an incident, to effect an arrest, or to protect themselves or others from imminent harm. Anything more than that can be deemed excessive force. If you examine the history of policing in the United States, what becomes, I think, apparent very quickly is that at its very foundations, it was designed in part to help create and maintain white supremacy. So slave patrols were the first formal state-sponsored police forces in North America. They actually predate the founding of this country. Slave patrols consisted of white property-owning men, and they were designed to prevent slave uprisings and also escape. They were particularly vital to maintaining white supremacy in areas where slaves outnumbered whites. And in fact, the first formal slave patrol was established in South Carolina, which is a colony where there were many more slaves than white people, and so whites felt like their supremacy was potentially in jeopardy. Slave patrols were, of course, disbanded in the wake of the Civil War, but police were subsequently called upon to enforce the Black Codes, which many of you guys may know about, but these were codes that were used to control freedmen and women and coerce labor. So they did things like outlaw loitering or unemployment among freedmen. The enforcement of these codes resulted in large increases in the incarceration of black men and women during the post-Civil War period. Black codes themselves were eradicated during Reconstruction, but by then the role of the police as agents of the state who were responsible for maintaining these racial hierarchies was, I think, bred into the marrow of policing in the U.S. And you see this role carried forward through time in things like officers participating in lynchings and, of course, in the enforcement of Jim Crow laws. As Michelle Alexander has written, Jim Crow laws were superseded by the war on drugs, which heralded an era of mass incarceration and police brutality. And I would argue that in this current era, police have become even more potent agents of efforts to maintain white supremacy. And this argument really rests on two pillars. First, we're living in an era when laws themselves cannot explicitly discriminate against particular racial ethnic groups. And that's the shift from the Jim Crow era and before. What can happen, though, is that laws can be differentially enforced across racial ethnic groups. So in the post-civil rights era, enforcement becomes, I think, the battleground. And of course, this is the purview of the police. Second, the consensual nature of drug activity gives officers very wide latitude to interfere in civilian life. Prior to the war on drugs, policing was a more reactive profession. Officers were deployed in response to civilian calls for help. But drug activity, by and large, is consensual. So now that the buyer or the dealer is going to call the police to report a sale. To enforce laws pertaining to drug possession and sales, then, officers have to shift to more of a proactive stance, where they decide what constitutes a possible crime. They identify particular activities, people, or places that are suspicious, and then they react and they intercede accordingly. That's a huge paradigm shift in the nature of policing, and it gives police many more powers than they had before. We've seen a massive increase in the resources flowing to police departments to support their prominent role in the war on drugs. For example, between 1992 and 2008, state and local expenditures on policing doubled. And during that same period, the number of sworn officers in the U.S. increased by 26%, although in some cities that increase was much greater. But it isn't just the resources that increased. Police powers also expanded. We eroded several key rights in order to support the war on drugs, but I'll focus here on erosions to the Fourth Amendment because it had a direct role in creating stop and frisk. The Fourth Amendment, as you guys probably know, was proposed by Congress in 1789, and it states that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, unless the standard of probable cause has been met. Now, the bar for probable cause has historically been set very high to protect civilians from unreasonable searches and seizures. The first erosion to the Fourth Amendment came in 1968 in the form of Terry versus Ohio. In Terry, the Supreme Court decided that officers could stop a civilian if they reasonably suspected, based on articulable facts, that the civilian was currently engaging in criminal activity or had engaged in criminal activity. The court also decided that officers could frisk a stopped person if they reasonably suspected that that person was armed and dangerous. I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding from legal scholars is that reasonable suspicion is a much lower bar for a search than probable cause. So basically, the Terry decision created a whole new category of police intervention in civilian life, and one that was initiated by the police with less evidence than had ever been required before. The Wren and Illinois decisions further eroded the Fourth Amendment. Wren allowed officers to make what's called a pretext stop. So in a pretext stop, an officer can stop, let's say, a car, ostensibly for a broken taillight, when his true purpose is actually to search the car for drugs. Illinois versus Wardlaw further lowered the bar to establish reasonable suspicion by saying that someone who might be running away from a police car could be deemed as engaging in suspicious activity that could trigger a stop and frisk. So collectively, this increase in funds flowing to police departments, this increase in police power, in police person power, and in the erosion of the Fourth Amendment, they all led to a proliferation of stop and frisk, and made stop and frisk, I think, a vital tool in the war on drugs. Data from New York City testifies to this proliferation. So between 2002 and late 2014, there were 5 million instances of stop and frisk in New York City. 85% of these stops did not result in an arrest or a ticket. People were simply let go. And in the vast majority of times, the people who were stopped were people of color. Stops were also highly geographically concentrated in poor Black and Latino areas. So, for example, in a four-year period, police made 52,000 stops in a single 8-block area that was home to just 14,000 people. And again, these stops generated very few actual arrests. You can see from the data that stop and frisk is very poor use of police resources if the actual intent is to catch criminals. But I would argue that that really isn't the purpose of mass stop and frisk, right? So looking at the demographics of stop and frisk, it seems like it's very much part and parcel of this long history of using police to maintain white supremacy. And I would say that it's been very effective in helping to achieve that goal. I'm going to transition now to talking about the health effects of stop and frisk. I'll draw on some great work that's being done by Abigail Sewell, Kevin Jefferson, and Hedwig Lee to consider the impact of stop and frisk on high blood pressure. And I'll also draw on some of my own work that was conducted with Nancy Krieger, Sophia Gruskin, and Lisa Moore on stop and frisk as a form of psychological violence that creates vulnerability to HIV among drug users. So let's start with the qualitative study. This study was conducted in the 46th precinct of New York City while it was experiencing a police drug crackdown. Crackdowns are emblematic of the war on drugs, and they involve many tactics, including repeated stop and frisks. This precinct was deeply impoverished, and most residents were Black or Latino. We conducted in-depth qualitative interviews with 40 people who lived in the precinct and were injecting drugs, and with 25 people who lived in the precinct and had not used drugs, hard drugs, recently. Interview domains included community police relationships and their impact on HIV, and we used grounded theory methods to analyze their transcripts. We found that stop and frisk without arrest or tickets was widespread, and participants really referred to these instances as stops for no reason or stops for nothing. So 2/3 of the injectors and 2/3 of the non-users reported either witnessing a stop and frisk or being directly targeted by a stop and frisk for nothing or for no reason when they were let go. Participants very clearly experienced these stops as a form of harassment because they were so common and because they rarely actually generated any kind of arrest. The relentless nature of these stops left many residents feeling insecure and uncomfortable whenever they were in public spaces, whenever they were just going about the daily legal business of their lives, like picking up a child from school, or as in this quote, buying a loaf of bread. In addition to being relentless and clearly experienced as a form of harassment, stop and frisk had other hallmarks of psychological violence. So police often use racial epithets and gender-based slurs during stops. During sweeps, people were often handcuffed and left lying on sidewalks face down, waiting to be frisked for several hours. Each stop and frisk also held the threat of extreme physical and sexual violence. So 2/3 of the injectors and 40% of the non-users experienced or witnessed police physical violence in their precinct. About 1/3 of injectors and 10% of non-users had experienced directly or witnessed police sexual violence. Now, these other kinds of violence are not the focus of my results today. They're covered in the couple of papers that I cited earlier, but every single stop and frisk held the threat of severe physical or sexual violence. So for all of these reasons, stop and frisks were experienced by community members as a form of psychological violence. And in particular, residents felt like the police targeted residents of their neighborhood because it was what they called the ghetto, because it had high levels of poverty and a high density of Black and Latino residents. So they really experienced the psychological violence as a form of racial, ethnic, structural discrimination. The psychological violence that was created by stop and frisk is, I think, an important health issue in and of itself, and one that we need to attend to. We also learned from the injecting participants that stop and frisk had major implications for HIV transmission in the precinct. So injecting residents were very, very hesitant to carry their own syringes as they walked through the precinct's public spaces because they were worried that officers would feel a syringe, which is hard and kind of long, that they would feel a syringe during a frisk, during a pat-down search. So to minimize their own risk of arrest, many participants simply started injecting right near where they bought drugs instead of maybe going home where things might be, conditions for injecting might be a little bit safer. Under these circumstances, they would typically inject with a syringe that they had gotten from a friend or from a dealer. And these sources of syringes are known not to be sterile. Other people chose to stash their syringes around the precinct, maybe near a fire hydrant, and they would go and retrieve them after they had bought drugs and go to a semi-public or public space to inject. That, of course, introduces issues around needle stick injuries to community members, and also people who were doing that, they didn't know if other folks were using those syringes when they weren't around. So these were great strategies to prevent arrest if you were frisked, but they undermined efforts to reduce HIV transmission. So let's turn to stop and frisk and high blood pressure in the general population. And again, here I'm sharing work by Abigail Sewell, Kevin Jefferson, and Hedwig Lee. Now note that they looked at multiple different health outcomes, and they found varying relationships between stop and frisk and these different health outcomes. Right here, we're going to focus on high blood pressure, but I refer you to the paper that I cited earlier to learn more. This is really a beautiful analysis. So Abigail, Kevin, and Hedwig used multi-level methods to examine relationships of stop and frisk to diagnose high blood pressure in New York City. In their study, individuals were nested in United Hospital Fund districts, and the data on stop and frisk were derived from an NYPD administrative database, data on individual level confounds and moderators, as well as on diagnosed high blood pressure, was drawn from the New York City Community Health Survey. So what did they find? So first, they found that Black, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander adults were more likely to report being diagnosed with high blood pressure if they lived in a health district with a higher rate of stops. Whites were less likely to report this outcome in such districts. Second, they found that district concentrations of frisks were associated with a higher risk of high blood pressure among Latino, API, and white adults. They also found that living in a district where minorities were more likely to be frisked than whites was associated with higher blood pressure among Black adults. The increased likelihood that police would use force in a district was associated with higher blood pressure among Latino and API adults. And finally, they found that Latinos were more likely to have diagnosed high blood pressure in districts where minorities were more likely to be targeted by police force than were whites. So just a few concluding thoughts. The current war on drugs era is clearly a continuation of a long history of using police to create and maintain racial hierarchies in the United States. A second point is that stop and frisk constitutes a form of police-related psychological violence that disproportionately targets people of color. A third point is that stop and frisk have health effects for people of color, and in particular here, what we've talked about is the increased HIV risk among people who inject drugs, and higher rates of diagnosed blood pressure among Black, Latino, and API adults, and in some cases among white adults too. Some possible thoughts for moving forward, I think, include restoring Fourth Amendment rights that made stop and frisk possible, eradicating stop and frisk. Stop and frisk clearly does not actually help us fight crime, given the few criminals who are actually identified in stop and frisks, and it has clear adverse consequences for human rights and for health. And generally, I would advocate for public health recognizing that excessive police violence in all of its forms, sexual, physical, neglectful, and psychological, is actually a very powerful determinant of health and health disparities. And before I sign off, I just want to flag the fact that Abigail, Kevin, and Hedgewood's paper is actually part of a special issue that Mindy Fulilove and I are pulling together for the Journal of Urban Health on police brutality as a public health issue, and that should come out in the next maybe 3 months, knock on wood.